Chris O'Connor here. Join our fabulous curmudgeonly community on Facebook at facebook.com/group/curmudgeonrock. Also look out for a Spotify playlist dedicated to this episode. Now, let's get started.
This is the Curmudgeon Rock Report, and this is your podcast, made by rock geek iconoclastic outsiders for rock geek iconoclastic outsiders. For those of you who lament that rock music has gone the way of jazz and slipped into niche genre status, we are here to keep that flame alive by providing insight, analysis, recommendations, and honest takes, not hot takes. And hey, there's a good chance you'll learn some rock history you never knew before. In 2001, a young band emerged from the San Francisco area with a dark, heavy, distortion-rich, yet sultry and somewhat sexy sound that combined swirling psychedelia with incessant hooks and glorious melodies. From the onset, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club were lumped in with bands such as The White Stripes and The Strokes as part of the new vanguard of alternative rock that was to serve as an antidote to the rap metal and nu metal dominating much of American rock radio at the time. Imagine the trippy spaciness of the Brian Jonestown Massacre, of which BRMC member Peter Hayes was a member of in the 1990s, combined with the cock of the walk swagger of Oasis and the menacing moodiness of the Jesus and Mary Chain, then infuse it all with the soulfulness and songwriting of American roots music forms such as blues, country, folk, and gospel. It was a potent combination that resulted in a 10-year run of one of the greatest and most rewarding catalogs of any American band of the decade of the noughties, or the aughts, whatever you want to call it. A few naysaying critics dismissed Black Rebel Motorcycle Club by using the band's acronym, BRMC, to refer to them as Band Rehashes Mary Chain. But this was a reductive and frankly rather ignorant oversight that failed to acknowledge the depth of rich diversity, innovative guitar work, and fantastic songwriting and lyrical caliber that characterizes the band's overall music. They never quite reached the mass popularity and commercial success of The White Stripes and The Strokes, but they amassed a strong, passionate, international cult following that exists to this day. Black Rebel Motorcycle Club are a band that deserves to not just be remembered, but praised as well. Of their contemporaries, the only other American band that had as consistently great of a decade run of albums as BRMC were the Black Keys. So, let's celebrate this most underrated of bands as we dive deep into Black Rebel Motorcycle Club's incredible discography. Welcome to the Curmudgeon Rock Report.
Okay, so before we start talking about Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, one of the best bands of its era, Arturo, we have a place to go. Where do you want to go?
Man, can I go to another world?
Yeah, absolutely. You can go to, matter of fact, you can go to a parallel universe.
Oh!
Wow. It's pretty nifty over here. It's candy-colored skies, licorice in the trees, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful place. It's a utopia for rock and roll. The rock and roll is still on the billboards. It's still in the arenas. It's still on the cover of Rolling Stone. There is such a thing as a cover of Rolling Stone. I don't know if it matters that much anymore on this side. But over there, rock and roll still predominates. This is just a fancy way of saying that this is a segment that we begin each episode of our here podcast with to cover new and newish albums by artists that we think deserve your respect and that should command your attention. Arturo, in the parallel universe, who are you covering on this episode?
Yeah, the indie rock band Limegarden and their debut album. Hailing from Brighton, England, this indie rock band, they're called Limegarden. They've just released their debut album, One More Thing. That's the name of the album. After putting out a staggering seven standalone singles between 2020 and 2022, they aren't the first band to merge traditional guitar-driven indie rock with pop music gloss and dynamics. But they're pretty darn good at it. In an era where most indie rock bands are either replicating their influences or outright suck due to an inability to write catchy melodies, hooks, and appealing lyrics, a band that manages to accomplish the latter with no frills or bells and whistles is simply good enough. Standout tracks, the sardonic Pop Star, which is already in the running for one of the catchiest, hookiest, best singles of the year. Love Song with its vintage early noughties indie guitar riff and the surging, almost anthemic Nepotism Baby in parentheses. It's a solid 3.5-star album from a band that, while not particularly great, certainly stands out among the plethora of mediocrity labeling itself indie rock these days. Chris?
Yeah, this band is 28 years too late to the party. Back in the late 90s, which was, as we in our four in our second in our fourth golden age of rock series, we established there were a couple of years there that were amazing beds of singles. A couple of these songs, especially Nepotism, I could see making the airwaves bit there even 20 years ago. Even I want to I think it's called I Want to Be You. Which is just a really great song that would have as even back then, like there was it was a good streak for soft rock songs. Like, and I know you're not much of a fan of the Postal Service, but there is that kind of they're kind of a beacon of soft rockness that was big 20 years ago, and I could see Limegarden doing that. But alas, here we are in 2024, where they do that really kind of catchy pop thing. But they have to, alas, unless somebody uses one of their songs in a TikTok video that gets viral, they probably won't get much traction. But yeah, like you said, another thing that I've noticed too, by the way, that a lot of these female-fronted and female-composed bands of the last 6 months, 12 months, Veruca Salt,
They
and
were pretty good band, though.
yeah, they were, but Veruca Salt and bands like that, and the sort of mid-90s, not obviously Luscious Jackson's their own category, but I'm just saying, but a lot of like mid-90s female rock bands, they're starting to make a comeback. Like Liz Phair is another one that's starting to kind of get to get a lot of reverence, and so it's kind of neat to see this revival. So. Yeah, I can see this band doing some things. Obviously, since they're British, let me guess, Mojo is raving about them. They seem like they're
They gave them a solid 4-star review.
Yeah.
They didn't put them on the cover or anything, or but they yeah
Yeah.
they didn't get a huge space in the review. They just got one of the
Which is
more.
weird because they're kind of a Mojo wheelhouse kind of band, so.
Just like a Wet Leg. They're kind of like file.
Yeah.
They're actually they sound a lot like Wet Leg in some instances.
Yeah, they actually kind of do. Although Wet Leg's a better band,
Yes, I
but
agree.
they do kind of sound, they have that kind of sound or those kind of influences. So there you go. So we're gonna stick to the UK next, and we're gonna go hip hop rather than pop. And this is a rapper. She's had quite a decade, actually, in terms of her profile and the attention she's gotten. But not only that, but she's also put out one of the best rap albums of the 2020s. We're talking about Little Sims. She's a an Afro-British rapper and singer. She released an album called Sometimes I Might Be Introvert late in 2021. Made a lot of top 10 lists that year, and the next year won the coveted Mercury Prize in the UK
And the curse
again.
that goes with it.
And the curse that goes with it, yeah, pretty much. But they see that this is a good thing, though. She came out with an album after that that was pretty good, and now she's back to doing something that she did before she broke out big. I mean, she's been around for a little while. She was in the underground in the British hip hop scene for quite a while. She has this series of EPs that she started back in 2014 that are all known as Drop, as in Drop 1, Drop 2, Drop 3000. and so on. Well, she's now on drop 7. This is the first of these drop EPs that she's done since 2020. And it's interesting with this one. She's a little bit of a departure for her. She's mostly known as somebody that delves in funky bass grooves and also Afrobeat rhythms in her production. She's worked a lot with Inflow, who's the house producer for the terrific throwback R&B collective known as Salt. And she's done a lot of work with Inflow, but she's not working with Inflow on this drop 7. She's working with a guy named Jaquab, who's a British producer who is more in the vein of house and experiments with Brazilian house and with grime, actually, like old school grime beats. There's a couple of songs on here you expect Dizzy Rascal to drop in and spit a verse or two. I mean, they're that orthodox. And so so she's going spare this time. So Gone is the bass, and Here Are the Drums. A lot of skittering, a lot of house, a lot of thump in this little EP. It's 15 minutes long and 7 songs. And so it's an in and out affair. And some really, really catchy stuff, some really good stuff. There's, again, I said she plays with Brazilian funk. There's a song called Fever on there, which is really great. There's Torch, which is extremely, extremely grime, as in, like, it might as well just have the trademark stamp that just says grime.
It's one of the two best tracks on the album.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely is. And then so you get this this minimalist house going all through the record until you get to the end, and you get a 3-minute really nice neo soul R&B nugget called Far Away, which is a little bit of a surprise, because up until then it's really an exercise in house music and just like orthodox house music, and then you get this little R&B nugget, and where she's singing and actually sounds pretty good. It makes me think that she ought to delve more into that kind of thing.
I hope so too, because I don't think much of her as a rapper, but anyway.
No, I think she's a great rapper, and you know, she's definitely grime.
She has the same flow in every track, and but every song she raps the same exact. She's no differentiation at all in her flow. Her lyrics are usually pretty good.
Yeah, the lyrics are great, and she's got a grime-tastic flow, like Arturo said. You know, there is a Little Sims patented flow.
It's the same. It's the same thing in every song.
And it shows up. But again, to me, this is a good little entry into the Sims canon. I think that this one is definitely better than Drop 6. At that point, you know, that's a very bass-heavy 15-minute, again, another 15-minute little record, 5 songs, and very bassy, but also very Afro-beaty. Whereas this one, I like the fact that she's playing with the house music and going for something a little bit different. Really, really works, and I think it's definitely worth checking out. So, yeah, Drop 7 by Little Sims. Check it out. Arturo, any other thoughts?
Yeah, as with all things related to Little Sims, my reaction to this EP is one big meh. It's telling that for a female Black artist, whatever positive reviews she gets in music media almost always comes from middle-aged white guys.
Yeah, pretty much.
In the American hip-hop scene, no one talks about her. In the British hip-hop scene, she may be something, but Mojo has never uttered a word about her.
Mojo's not exactly the go-to source for hip hop, though.
Yeah, but even then, even aside from Mojo, she doesn't get written about that much. She won a Mercury Prize a while back for that 2021 album, and she hasn't really moved the needle since. Notice she put out an album late in 2022. That album came and went without.
Yeah, not much fanfare.
No, that's nothing true for that album. Curse of the Mercury Prize, and now she has this EP that. Yeah, there's some stuff on it, but overall, listen, people are writing about how this is her bold excursion into pure dance music. Mm-hmm. To me, most of it sounds like second-rate MIA. even down to the vocal delivery, especially the song Fever.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, Fever's very MIA.
That's an MIA ripoff. And MIA, also a British artist, you know, not surprising. Remember, the British EDM artist, I remember MIA from back in the noughties.
Oh, yeah,
right?
She's great.
She's one of the unsung pioneers of trap music, especially in its mainstream crossover. People don't talk about her enough, and they should.
Yeah,
however,
they really should. Yeah,
this being a Little Sims release, there are always a couple of songs that kind of make it worth your while. Torch, like you said earlier, also sounds like another female EDM artist from the noughties. Remember Peaches? This song sounds a lot like Peaches. But this is a little more convincing in its groove and edgy, almost industrial style arrangement. It doesn't say much for Little Sims' rapping skills or overall vocal ability that the best track on the whole EP is an instrumental or nearly all instrumental called SOS.
Yeah.
I could point my finger as to why Little Sims' beats are at their best. Actually, I can't really. Why her beats are at their best when she's drawing from African rhythms. I don't know why, but this is a pretty nifty hybrid of both house and trap styles.
Well, but, I mean, kind of figures the whole, you know, originally being from Nigeria thing might have an influence on that.
Maybe. It could be. But overall to me is meh.
Chris here again. Arturo and I have differing feelings about the subscription streaming service Spotify. While he likes to rail against the algorithmic component, I like the ability to find and then manage a personal catalog of music. The program is especially great for assembling playlists. Well, guess what? We've assembled a playlist to accompany this episode. The playlist features a healthy mix of all the music we describe and analyze during the episode. Think of it as a soundtrack to your curmudgeonly life. Find the link in this episode's description. And also become a member of our curmudgeonly community on Facebook if you haven't done so already. Let's now return to our regularly scheduled programming. Let's now talk about Black Rebel Motorcycle Club. As Arturo alluded to, they are one of the best bands of their era, specifically the first decade of the 21st century, the 2000s. And to me, that band stands for two things, or there's really two standout things that make them special. One is sensuality. They're one of the most sensual bands of their era. I mean, really, the components of it, there's maximal menace and staggering swagger. It's just, you know, the arrangements practically swoon. I mean, they just fill the speakers, and it's just a lot of going on, a lot of different styles, a lot of different sounds, a lot, you know, just really hypnotic effects, guitar, all of that. They're just a big, big, maximal, huge band, and just sensual as hell. And then the other thing that stands out about this band, and we'll talk about this as we go along as well, is that they have their integrity as a band is absolutely impeccable. All of the energy that they poured out went into their music. They really remained bullshit free, which is what I love about this band. They were balls out great, dedicated to the rock. And here, I'm going to share a very telling quote from one of the band leaders, Peter Hayes. This is from a Pop Matters interview that ran in 2007. And he's kind of talking about the cult of personality and what they really want to stand for. So here's the quote. Quote, "There's nothing worse than when you see a band that's got their hit on the OC or whatever the fuck it is, the TV show or the car commercial, and they go out and they're playing their set and people are clapping and they play that one song and everybody goes apeshit, and then they do the next song and everybody claps politely. That ain't music. That's a ham sandwich. That's not fans. That's not people loving the music or loving the song. We've always tried to have fans of music. So when you say, can we see ourselves being that? No, I can't. We're trying to go about it in a different way in terms of presenting our music to people. In this time and age, maybe what we do is too old school for people. It used to be respected, but maybe now things have come around to consuming and it's just about money. It's more respected how much money, more money to make you make instead of what music you make. Our idea is we signed to a major label and tried to keep our ideals of how things should be done within that system, and we've held to it pretty good. Because of that, maybe we won't have millions of records sold, but at this point in time, I'd rather have respect for ourselves. And boy, did they keep that self-respect, huh, Arturo?
Yeah, they did. I mean, when I hear or read, both hear and read this quote, I think of it not so much as a condemnation of the music industry, but a condemnation of music fandom itself.
Yeah.
A condemnation of music fans or people who call themselves music fans. Let me transpose what he's saying here to like modern times. And as far as like, you know, this the big celebrity, the celebrity dumb or celebrityhood that's celebrated so much in music now. I'll choose her because she's the clearest example, Taylor Swift.
Yep.
When people talk about Taylor Swift, no one really talks about her music. They're always talking about how much money she makes, how much money she has, how big her concerts are, who she's dating, what she's doing with her personal life, how many streams of her music there are on Spotify, and how many Grammy awards she's won. But no one talks about her music. They talk about her money and her awards, but they don't talk about her music itself. Now, personally, one of the reasons I think it is that, with some exceptions, I do like the Folklore and Evermore albums from 2020, but a lot of her music is pretty shallow. You know, a lot of it lacks a lot of depth, some of her best stuff, but yet she's celebrated for her success more than the quality of her music, of which there is some in there. But you can say this for a lot of big name artists who are more famous for being famous than they are for their music.
Yeah, Beyonce is another one. Yeah.
Ed Sheeran is another one, you know. Yeah. What about their music? Instead of like, oh yeah, look how much money they made. Look how many streams they have on Spotify. Look at these sold out stadium shows. Okay. Oh, and they won all these awards. What about their music? Tell me about their music. No one talks about their music. Nope. Beyonce gets talked about her music, though. Her Lemonade album kind of turned the corner on that. People started talking about her as a musician after Lemonade came out. And the same thing with Renaissance.
About time. About time, because she's fucking great.
That hasn't happened to Taylor Swift quite yet.
No, and, not to the same degree. No.
Yeah. So, you know, again, I point the finger at the people, really. And it's the people who call themselves music fans who really aren't the true diehard music fans. Like Peter Hayes said, you know, they hear the song in the beer commercial or the car commercial or in a video game, and they go see the band and the artist perform live. They hear their hit, they go crazy. And then once they play the rest of their set, they go back to their smartphones.
Yep. Yeah, pretty much. And so, but Black Rebel Motorcycle Club was kind of an exception to that rule, that the folks that stayed with them stayed with them for the music. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're really focusing on now, that they're a band that was successful enough. They had their moment in the sun on MTV briefly in 2003. And, you know, they had a couple of modest successes in terms of interest in a couple of their records. But they did enough to build up a cult of personality and to build up a following and to build up a fandom that really respected them for the music and for the styles that they blended. And so they're a band with a legacy. And so let's start talking about that. Tell us a little bit about Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, their beginnings, and let's start telling this story.
The origin story. While Black Rebel Motorcycle Club have consistently been a trio throughout their over 20-year existence, the core duo always has been the partnership between singer, songwriter, guitarists Peter Hayes and Robert Levon Bean. Both grew up in the San Francisco suburb of Lafayette, California. While Bean had a pretty steady home life with his father, Michael Bean, being a pretty well-respected musician and sound engineer in the music business, Hayes had a rather difficult, turbulent and unstable family life at home. Being high school buddies, Hayes would often park his car and sleep just down the street in his car from the Bean household. Eventually, Mr. Bean, Robert's dad, not Rowan Atkinson, invited Hayes to come in and live with his family. Their friendship grew even stronger during this time, with not just a love of music, but a love of similar bands and artists bringing them together. Both Hayes and Bean were budding guitarists, but Hayes got the big break first in his early 20s when, via Bean's father's connections, He got to audition for a spot in the Brian Jonestown Massacre, the most buzzworded psychedelic rock band of that time. Anton Newcomb's now legendary underground band were notorious for their wild antics of drugging, fighting, and getting busted by the cops during the mid to late 1990s. And the 2004 documentary Dig captures Newcomb's insanity in full glory. If you haven't watched it, check it out. In it, you can see scenes where Peter Hayes is hanging around in the background and offering occasional comments as he was in the band circa 1997 to 98. It's important to note that Hayes's involvement with the BJM, Brian Jonestown Massacre, during this time, because the dark, heavy psychedelia that Anton Newcomb crafted, it was as much, if not more, of an influence on the future sound of Black Rebel Motorcycle Club than the Jesus and Mary Chain, a band BRMC eventually got compared to excessively so. In any case, Hayes left the Brian Jonestown Massacre behind, returned to the Bay Area, and formed a band with his old friend Robert Bean in 1998. They named themselves Black Rebel Motorcycle Club after Marlon Brando's motorcycle gang in the 1953 film The Wild One. They found their drummer and British expatriate Nick Jago, whose parents had moved to California sometime before. The trio was set, and in short time, no doubt aided by Bean's father's connections, the band started to get noticed in the Bay Area music scene, eventually signing to Virgin Records. Chris?
Yeah, it's interesting that they have their roots in Brian Jonestown Massacre, and I think you're right that they probably are as indebted to Jonestown and that sort of neo-psychedelic aesthetic as they are to any of the Britannia that they obviously were influenced by too. But and so it's this really interesting mix of Manchester type rock and roll and San Francisco neo-psychedelia and just being able to sort of splice together the two is a pretty neat thing. And that's the origin story. That's where they started was splicing those two. Now, obviously, we'll talk about this as we go along. They evolved into being something like wholly unique and wholly special. But as a starting point, that ain't bad.
Yeah, not at all. All right. So we go to their first album. It's called BRMC, basically the acronym for their name, in 2001. From the very first album, Black Rebel's sound template was set, and remarkably so, considering that it's a self-produced effort. Yes, you can hear some of the Jesus and Mary Chain's dark sexiness, and Robert Bean can't help it if he sounds like the Mary Chain singer Jim Reed at times.
Yeah.
But the moniker band rehashes Mary Chain was then and still is outright bullshit. As I stated earlier, you certainly hear the swagger and pop hooks of Oasis in the rockers and the trippy spaciness of the Brian Jonestown Massacre in the more mid-tempo numbers. But you also hear the heavy, hard rock rhythms of Led Zeppelin and the guitar noise freakouts of Sonic Youth and Dinosaur Jr. It's the best of 1970s hard rock combined with the best of 1980s alternative rock with the best of 1990s Britpop in one delectable rock candy mountain package. The stampeding onslaught of Whatever Happened to My Rock and Roll is their most well-known single, and perhaps to this day the band's signature song. But brilliant songs abound on this record. On Spread Your Love, the band lift the bass line and lead guitar lick from Norman Greenbaum's 1970 hippie Christian rock song, Spirit in the Sky, and transpose it to a glam rock rhythm. The result is dark, heavy, sludgy glam rock, as if Oasis and Slade got jumped in a back alley by Alice in Chains. Red Eyes and Tears, with its stalking, lurching bass, has one of the slinkiest, sexiest guitar riffs you'll ever hear. The alluring, loud, soft dynamic of Awake sets the stage for one of the most ear-splittingly loud tracks in BRMC's entire catalog. It's a triumphant album that some lesser knowledgeable music fans think is their best, but in fact only portends the brilliance that is to come later on in their discography. Chris?
Yeah, certainly I would say portentous is a good descriptor for this record, because at this point they're still figuring out who they are. They're still kind of figuring out what their identity is. They obviously have a pretty expansive encyclopedia of influences, and they definitely show up here. That it's kind of a dichotomous record. So, you know, on the one hand, you've got like the Whatever Happened to My Rock and Roll Punk Song. You've got Spread Your Love. And it's kind of funny, in my notes, I actually said that, that this is a demonic, drugged out cousin of Norman Greenbaum's Spirit in the Sky. And so you've got those type of bangers, Red Eyes and Tears, which is awesome on the one end. But then on the other hand, you've got this psychedelic pop and just sort of like almost like mid-tempo, lovely, almost haunting spookiness, but almost like a spooky loveliness, I guess is what you could put it as. And here's a term I picked up from a review on allmusic.com of this record. The song Too Real is described as, quote, diaphanous space pop, which is perfect. Diaphanous, for those non-English and non-journalism majors out there, is really it's characterized by extreme delicacy. That's the Merriam-Webster definition. And it's really ethereal and extreme delicacy, you know, such fineness and texture as to permit seeing through. So in other words, it's so light and fluffy, you can almost put your hand through it. And it's got that kind of aesthetic, and it's stretched out and really, really pretty. I personally think Too Real is the best song on the record. I would say like that. And personally for me, Red Eyes and Tears. But I also am a big fan of album closer Salvation, too. I mean, that's more in the sort of diaphanous realm. Right. And so it's just interesting to hear them go from to those extremes where, you know, they're basically they're hinting at the Stone Roses on Red Eyes and Tears. It's very, very rock and drone. And then to go from there to like psychedelic slop at the end of the record is pretty alarming. And so what they are is that they're a really talented duo or trio in search for a unified identity. They don't quite find it on this record, but the attempts and the pursuits are pretty thrilling. And right. I could see why people are a huge fan of this record, because again, there's just a purpose and there's an energy to this record that is pretty spectacular in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think the next album's better.
I do too, by the way.
Yeah. Take Them on Your Own from 2003. There was a lot of critical buzz during the follow-up to BRMC's second album. I remember Mojo Magazine at the time doing an entire feature on the band recording the album in the studio. When it finally came out, Take Them on Your Own got mixed reviews. More importantly, while it sold reasonably well for an under-the-radar alternative rock band in an era where such rock music was becoming passé, it didn't do well enough to appease Virgin's large expectations, which led to the band and label mutually agreeing to part ways in 2004. It's a damn shame, too, because 21 years afterward, Take Them on Your Own has aged incredibly well and turns out to be a phenomenal album. This is the album where BRMC finally bury the Jesus and Mary Chain comparisons in the dirt. On this record, Black Rebel established themselves as an even darker band than the Mary Chain. Heavier, more muscular, more rocking, with meatier riffs, prettier melodies and catchier hooks. Better and smarter lyrics, too, as Hayes and Bean break off from the standard doomed romance trope that has doomed the Mary Chain for almost 40 years ago until now. And they delve into astute and angry socio-political commentary, especially with the Second Gulf War in the backdrop to the album's release. Another thing to notice about this album, especially in comparison to the first one, is how the production, again, the album is self-produced, conveys vocals and guitars submerged in a static-like sound throughout. Some people found this to be a point of contention with the record, but that's missing the point. One of the main lyrical themes of the album is a society and world lost in its own apathy and self-absorption, cut off from what's going on in the world. This is most poignantly expressed in hypnotic tracks such as Generation and Ha Ha Hi Babe. The static-filled sound reflects a gauze with which we're covering our eyes, you know. The static sound also reflects conflict, okay, and abrasiveness abounds on this album, not just on the political songs, especially on U.S. Government, originally titled Kill the U.S. Government, but even on the personal relationship songs, such as the raging six-barrel shotgun and the groovetastic In Like the Rose, where despair to the point of violence pervades. By the time you get to the back-to-back barn burner tracks that end the album, Going Under and The Relentless Heart and Soul, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club take you to the conclusion that the world is a dying place and both the personal and political intertwine in a ball of hypertension that's about to blow. It's a stunning rock record and one of the most underrated and undersung of the noughties. Chris?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think the thing about this record immediately is just there's an energy to it. There's just a raw energy that they take the sort of the form, and they take the songwriting chops that they displayed on the debut, and they amp it up. I mean, just the energy, the tempos are stronger, the guitars crack more, the drums bang harder, and it's weird because there's a lot of more of this sort of kinetic energy, but you're right. It is a dark record. I love Generation. Yeah. Generation is great. And then obviously, and this is something that we'll talk about as we go along. This band ended their records amazingly well.
Yeah, they did.
Like the last three or four songs on all of their records are really strong. But here, you know, Heart and Soul is like 7 minutes of just intensity. Just really intense stuff. And so just the energy, there's the kinesis of it, there's the intensity of it, it's all ratcheted up from BRMC, and the Britophile stuff is starting to disappear at this point, that they're starting to kind of find their voice as a band, and it has this it becomes like a lot more apparent on the next record, but this sort of almost rooted in sort of orthodox like 50s and 60s rock and roll.
Right.
And you start to kind of get that sense, but just really, again, just strong stuff. And what I like about it, it's a relentless record. And then out of nowhere comes And I'm Aching, which is just this beautiful acoustic ballad. And up until then, you know, and that comes right after U.S. Government.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so you get this where it just builds, and then it just gets this lovely break where they do this ballad and this you know, this heartache song, and then boom, boom, bang, bang again. And so it's just kind of a strange sudden effect, but it's really, really cool. So yes, very, very strong record. I think it is better than BRMC. And it was a harbinger of things to come, where this band was starting to become singular.
On this episode, we examined and praised the work of the brilliant and underrated Black Rebel Motorcycle Club. For the next episode, we're going to take a look at one of the most iconic American bands of the 1960s, The Doors. Everyone knows them. Everyone knows their most famous songs. Yet, especially among millennial and Gen Z generation music fans, there's a lot of derision and dislike of the band evident on social media, YouTube comments, and numerous or even endless blogs and contemporary music media reviews. Up until the 1990s, The Doors were untouchable in their coolness and hipness factor. Now, a lot of younger generation rock fans see Jim Morrison as nothing more than an obnoxious, drunken clown. What happened? Well, at least this curmudgeon can pinpoint the root of the problem to a certain movie from the early 1990s. In addition, we're going to break down all six of the Morrison era albums and make the argument as to why they're not only one of the 20 greatest American bands of all time, but also a band whose influence and impact is so profound that it stretches across multiple decades, even up to now. Join us next time as the Curmudgeon Rock Report will get defiant and bring you In Defense of the Doors. All right, next, their third album, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, brought you Howl in 2005. Now, the band got a new record deal with RCA after they split with Virgin, and with the new record label came a new musical direction, again, self-produced. Hints and images, and tinges, I should say, of American roots music, such as blues, folk, and country, were always detectable in the band's sonic brew, particularly the blues. But BRMC didn't waste time with a transitional record and dived headfirst into Americana with the album that is arguably their masterpiece, Howl. Peter Hayes and Robert Bean had grown by leaps and bounds as both songwriters, melodicists, and lyricists. And with Howl, it's absolutely stunning how unaffected, genuine, and authentic their approach to and presentation of American roots music is. As much as I love the Brian Jonestown Massacre, Anton Newcomb's dabblings in Americana sometimes carried with them a strong whiff of irony. As much as I love the White Stripes, Jack White's ventures into country and folk sometimes seemed like he was trying too hard to be authentic, like they were a little contrived even when they were well-crafted. Neither Hayes nor Bean put on any vocal affectations with the rootsy material on Howl. The key thing here is that they play it straight. By approaching the songs with sincerity, they do the songs justice by imbuing them with the soulfulness that they deserve and thereby imbue the lyrics with the depth and pathos that they were intended to have. Ain't No Easy Way, one of the album's singles, is a romping slice of country blues that recalls the Rolling Stones' late 1960s excursions. Devil's Waitin' and Fault Line are both weary, heart-worn folk at its most poignant. The standout track, however, is the majestic Gospel of Promise, one of the greatest individual tracks in BRMC's entire catalog. Sounding like one of Richard Manuel's gorgeous elegies from any of the band's peak late 1960s albums, the song soars from one stirring melody to another, kept together by a chord progression on loan from God. While the album didn't exactly set the world on fire sales-wise, critics got back on the Black Rebel Motorcycle Club bandwagon by giving it universal praise for its authentic turn toward American roots music and exquisite songwriting. To this day, it sounds just as fresh as it was when it was released, and among their hardcore cult fan base, it's an undisputed favorite. Chris?
Yeah, it would be a mistake to actually to call this album a departure from the first two. What it does is it really builds on them finding their identity, but they make it more transparent in going to the roots music. And here's another mistake. It's not a departure. It's an evolution. So that's one thing. Another thing is when people think like roots music or they think Americana, they immediately, the minds will go to minimalism. Well, this band had no use for minimalism. They're about as maximal a band as possible. And, you know, they filled the entire space that they did. And so here they have like Ain't No Easy Way is just a romp. And it just, you know, it's like barn floor stomp kind of almost country-ish music. But the whole space is filled. And, you know, it's a banging track. Even the song there's a song on there called Gospel Song. Which, yes, starts off as gentle acoustic blues, but even that rises into just, you know, squeaky, squonky electric guitar, bash, bash, boom, boom, clang, and just fills up the entire, you know, both speakers where they're just, there's ooze coming out of it. So again, maximal still, but they're wearing their hearts on their sleeves here. I think that's more what it is because they're starting to find their voices as songwriters. I think it becomes more about what idioms are best to convey their messages and their feeling.
Right.
And I think that's where the more acoustic instrumentation comes from. That's where the country comes in. That's where the folk comes in. Mm-hmm. And that's where sort of the more deliberate blues comes in as well. And again, this album ends amazingly well with three songs in a row that are all just wonderful. Sympathetic Noose, which is just a wonderful pop song. The Line, which is just an amazing rock song. And then it ends with this sort of weird, spooky 3-minute long thing called Open Invitation.
Yeah,
which is just kind of a cool note of almost desert noir, in some respects. Okay, not Calexico kind of desert noir, but you know what I mean. It has that kind of almost inherent sort of in the past. You know, the ghosts right. of the desert kind of feel. So, right. I don't think it's their best record. We'll talk about that shortly, but I think it's pretty goddamn good, and it's where they really. This is where they officially became BRMC. They officially have a voice. They have a unified vision, and their swagger is in takeover mode from here on out.
Right. Definitely. Yeah,
at least in that decade, first decade.
And this leads us to the next one, Baby 81 from 2007. When Black Rebel Motorcycle Club returned with their fourth album, their second for RCA Records, it was a return to loud, heavy rock music, but this time with a twist. They took their patented, dark, heavy, sultry, swaggering, psychedelic, riff-laden sound of their early records and augmented it with the songwriting lessons and chops that they developed and showed off on their previous album, The Journey into Traditional American Roots Music, that was Howl. The result was Baby 81, a record that amplified everything that was great and special about BRMC to 10 and beyond. The album is a stunning masterclass in rock musicianship and performance, impeccable songwriting, studio craftsmanship and production, once again, self-produced, and an overall sense of snarling, menacing rock and roll attitude that not a single other rock band or album of 2007 comes close to. At the time of its release, it got average reviews, but this was due more to critics expecting Howl Part 2 and not the refinement and perfecting of the band's identity that Baby 81 really represented. More importantly, it solidified their fan base internationally. They were always a little bigger in the UK and Europe than in the US, and it consolidated their growing, passionate cult fan base. They would never become an arena band, but they were now permanently a band that could reliably sell out 1,500 to 2,000 capacity venues anywhere. And they made some licensing money off video games too. The song Weapon of Choice was featured in both Guitar Hero World Tour and Driver San Francisco, as well as Ferrari Challenge Trofeo Pirelli. I have no idea who that is, but you know what? Weapon of Choice isn't even close to being among the best songs on this stunning album.
No, not at all.
Took Out Alone kicks the album off with a menacing, strutting riff that manages to be both sexy and ballsy at the same time, ending with an incessant heavy metal riff played on Robert Bean's bass, no less, that sparks off a feedback bonanza. Berlin, featured in the game Shaun White Snowboarding, is one of BRMC's finest singles, chugging along with another heaven-sent riff and erupting with the catchy chorus. Suicide's Easy, What Happened to the Revolution? Cold Wind is the closest the band ever came to being a straight-up arena rock band. And All You Do Is Talk is an epic ballad that both Reed brothers from the Jesus and Mary Chain and Noel Gallagher would sell their souls for. The beauty of this album lies in its relentless momentum. Even the slower songs carry a persistent edge that make the track list flow immaculately. I mentioned earlier that Howl is arguably their best album. Well, Baby 81 is the other album you can make that argument for, and it's quite possibly their definitive album. Chris?
Oh, I'll make the argument. It is their definitive record. It's the culmination of everything that they've done. Yeah. And I think the most striking thing about it is at this point, they've kind of lost the reverb heaviness of the first record, and it's really more of an organic sound at this point, and a hell of a guitar sound at this point. I mean, at this point, you could say that they're a guitar band. I think that they're as indebted to the Stones and Oasis on Baby 81 as they are anybody. So there's a few things to say about this record and about the band at this point. So Robert Bean, from that same article that I quoted from earlier in Pop Matters from 2007, he's talking about this record and about where they were as a band at the time. He says, quote, "It feels like we're just getting started. Quote, it feels like we're introducing people to the band. We don't feel like we're through the door yet. Maybe if we could make a record like Howl without feeling like we have to make an excuse for it, that's the dream, to make the music you want and not have to answer for it to the label or whoever. But in some way with music, it's better if you feel like you've had your head on the chopping block each time, because it makes you panic and write like you've got to save your own life." And I think that that's telling, because the urgency of this record, that you know, there's not an ounce of fat on it. I think it flows well. It's one great rock song after another. I think it's one of the best 25 rock albums of the 21st century, which is kind of weird because it came out in 2007, which has several other of those 25 best records, you know, MGMT's Oracular Spectacular, LCD Sound System, Sound of Silver, Radiohead's In Rainbows, and a bunch of other great albums came out that year. And just like, again, one great song after another, 666 Conducer, All You Do Is Talk, Need Some Air, and then an amazing 1-2 punch at the end of the record, American X and Am I Only. The former has got a very sort of Television or Neil Young jammy vibe to it, with probably or arguably the best lead guitar and best soloing they ever had on one of their songs on the album, and just kind of goes on and it just builds and it's really, really great. And then Am I Only is just this beautiful, not ballad, but just really intense mid-tempo rock song, again, that just sort of builds to this stunning coda. It's absolutely gorgeous. You know, Long Live the Mellotron. just really, really profound, profound stuff. And so, again, to me, it just, it is a really just great traditional rock record. It has lots of different colors, lots of different hues. It's, you know, again, it's maximally menaceful. It's just that staggering swagger. It's it's just a marvelous, marvelous record. And it's one that, you know, I hadn't listened to in a few years before this, but I just remember when it came out in 2007, I listened to it incessantly for like 2 months. And I fell in love with this band. And now I'm falling in love with them all over again.
Yeah. Good. And we hope you do too out there in listener land. The next album, Beat the Devil's Tattoo from 2010. By the time the new decade arrived, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club had a new drummer. Depending on who you believe, Nick Jago was either fired or he mutually parted ways with Peter Hayes and Robert Bean. Either way, his mental health issues and desire to pursue a solo career meant time for a change. Enter Leah Shapiro, formerly of the Ravenettes. It's hard to say if she's a better drummer than Jago, because the latter certainly had an edgy swing to his play. But Shapiro is a harder hitting drummer, and she really lifts the material on BRMC's fifth album, Beat the Devil's Tattoo, and the first on the band's own Abstract Dragon label, distributed by Vagrant Records, a subsidiary of BMG. They're pretty much a self-sustained outfit at this point. The album represents a hybrid of the rootsy Americana of Howl and the full-bore roar of Baby 81. In fact, there are elements of all the previous BRMC albums on Beat the Devil's Tattoo. While that may sound like recycling to some, and it certainly did to some critics at the time, the record's saving grace is in how well-crafted and tight the songs are, making the album's predictable style feel more comforting than rehashed. It's a testament to BRMC's brilliance at this point that they could pull it off. Conscience Killer pocketed the band some more cash with its inclusion in the video game Need for Speed Hot Pursuit, and it freaking rocks. Starting as a blues incantation before transitioning into one of the band's most devastating rockers ever, Sweet Feeling and The Toll continue Peter Hayes's penchant for resonant, aching folk ballads. The title track, also used in the 2019 movie Hellboy, is probably the heaviest slice of pure blues rock the band ever did. Half State ends the album with a serpentine groove jam. Beat the Devil's Tattoo is the final album in Black Rebel Motorcycle Club's Imperial Phase, and in its brilliant run of albums that mark them as one of America's finest rock and roll bands of the 21st century's first decade. Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. And the main thing to say about Beat the Devil's Tattoo, nasty ass guitar.
Yeah.
For the most part, with the, like you said, it has The Toll, which is a beautiful folk rock song. But other than a couple of things on there, it's just a big, fat, nasty ass guitar record. Lots of fat ass riffs, a lot of crunch, a lot of growl. Yeah. A lot of loud songs. I mean, hell, if you're going to make a record and if you're going to have a song on it called War Machine, you better make that shit as gnarly as possible, right?
Yeah.
I'm telling you. Yeah. And then I also love Mama Taught Me Better because it's, tough and fuzzy and loud and propulsive. It's a real nad pumper, to quote an old friend of ours. Yeah. And so really just brontosaurus shit all through the record. And so that's what I think. And I think you're right. It is kind of a hybrid of, you get back to some more of the Americana pangs and sort of the country rock pangs, especially the title song. The title song is very much a country rock type of song. And so you get that from Howl, and you get the consistency and the bangingness of Baby 81, and you put it into this record. So yeah, there you go. At this point, I think that when they started, they were more sort of a reverby, neo-shoegaze, neo-psychedelic type of band. And by the end of this run, this great run, they're just a flat-out guitar band.
Yeah.
They're just kicking ass and taking names with guitar. And, and both of them were really, really good guitar players. That's the thing,
I mean, they switched instruments.
They switched and they could both solo and they could both riff like motherfuckers.
Yeah.
For sure. So yeah, that's what I'd say. So if this was how they went out, if this was sort of their peak, they're just off peak. It's a good way to end a hell of a 10-year streak.
Yeah. So after that, up to now, well, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club only released two albums in the tens or the teens, whatever you want to call them. Spectre at the Feast from 2013 and Wrong Creatures from 2018. Neither of them are particularly bad, but they aren't particularly great either.
Nope.
By this point, the band really did start to recycle themselves creatively, and the records reflect the sound of a tired band, perhaps creatively spent. What the decade of the tens hasn't diminished, though, is the band's touring schedule. They spent much of the decade doing constant touring, and not just the touring cycles for the above-mentioned albums. As I said before, their passionate cult following is a bit bigger in the UK and Europe than in the States, and they spent much of the 2010s doing the seemingly endless European festival circuit. During this decade, they also toured South America, meaning Argentina, Chile, and Brazil, Mexico, South Africa, Japan, China, the latter including shows in Beijing and Shanghai, and Australia and New Zealand. Between all the international and U.S. touring and the video game licensing, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club have made quite a bit of money for themselves for an under-the-radar underground band. But, Chris, what do you think the band's real legacy is?
What do I think their legacy is? I said at the beginning, I think it's their integrity. The fact that they were able to essentially carve out their legacy and put together that catalog and that string of great albums on their terms, that they were signed to a major label. And they were, with the exception that they did a little bit of the video game licensing bit to make some money, but they really they kept growing and they kept learning and they kept experimenting. And, what they did is they had the integrity and they had the courage to sort of form themselves on the fly from album to album. And, again, they started off as sort of as this dichotomous band of doing psychedelic on the one hand and the sort of, fuzzy, crunchy, kick-ass rock on the other. And it really turned into this vision that took a whole bunch of American musical styles and rolled them up into sort of a rebel. Hey, you know, they were aptly named. You know, they had a rebellious streak to them. And so they kind of came up with this rebel brew of all these styles and really just became pretty singular. I mean, there's not they when I think of Black Rebel Motorcycle Club and it's like, well, who do they sound like? Well, they sound like Black Rebel Motorcycle Club.
Yeah.
And they're one of the few bands of the last 25 years that you can really say that about. I say that about Kurt Vile a lot.
Yeah.
That Kurt Vile sounds like Kurt Vile. And so there's very few artists that are in that category that they kind of invented their own thing, that they had that talent. And, you know, they combined their guitar chops with that self-style production, with that maximalism. And that's the thing, you know, the fact that they did all of these things that generally speaking are rendered minimally, but they did them maximally.
Right.
That really is part of their legacy too, that, you know, so there's a lot there. They're just, you know, their legacy really is one of the best bands of their era. Like I said, they did it with integrity and they did it with sensuality and they, you know, they, some of their stuff was R-A-W-K.
Yeah.
And some of their stuff was R-O-K-K.
Right.
Rock and rock.
Yeah. To me, they're also like, I mean, I agree with what you said, but also they're like the ultimate parallel universe band.
Yeah.
like a parallel universe.
Pretty much.
They would have been Muse instead of Muse, you know, it would have been these guys. And I like Muse. I shouldn't say that. I would say that they would have been more like big, like Kings of Leon big.
Yeah.
What Black Rebel should have been because they're that good. They were that good.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting when you look back on it that when you think about like 2004, 2005, there were a bunch of these bands that everybody's like, who's going to carry forward the rock mantle and who's going to take it into the tens? And you know, you had the Stripes, you had the Black Keys, you had these guys, you know, you had like the Vines, you know, Bright Eyes was there for a little bit, you know, all that. And of course, the funny part was is the answer was nobody carried into the 2010s because rock and roll as a you know as a broad form for the kids kind of died. But Black Rebel Motorcycle Club
the Black Keys came. They were probably the one.
Yeah, 2011. Yeah. You know, like 2011, 2012. They kind of peaked and they had you know, like Gold on the Ceiling and stuff like that in the early tens. But they were about the only one that really extended beyond that. But it was just kind of funny. That of all those bands, they might have been the best. Black Rebel.
I agree. Yeah, they might have been the best. Oh, and not better than the White Stripes. That's the one band I would put above.
Yeah. I would say, but they're pretty close to the Stripes.
They are.
Yeah, and it's you know, and yeah, I like I said, you can't really say that they're better songwriters than Jack White, but they're close.
Yeah, they're pretty close.
They really are close. So special band. Special band.
We love them. They're a curmudgeonly favorite.
And with that, as we always do at the end of these episodes, we encourage you to join our curmudgeonly community on Facebook. Arturo is in the midst of rolling out his studio albums, best studio albums by year. He just put up 2007 a couple of days ago, which again, we said is just a really surprisingly great and deep year for rock records. So definitely check that out. And join in the mirth and merriment up there. You can check it out at facebook.com/group/curmudgeonrock. If you have anything to say, if you're also a big BRMC fan, or if you think that we're full of crap and you think they suck, definitely just reach out to us at curmudgeonrock@gmail.com. We'd love to have the fan mail. And then also check the show notes or check the description for this episode wherever you accessed our podcast. And access our Spotify playlist where I will be dropping in all five of these records that we talked about from Black Rebel Motorcycle Club into one singular playlist for you to check out via Spotify. It'll be a special time had by all.